Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Anthony Backus was sitting on a high-back chair in his living room, staring at a fire located in the fireplace. His sunken-in, lifeless eyes were locked onto the flames. Judging by his lack of movement and his emotionless face, one could easily suspect that there was no life left in him. An empty bottle of brandy sat on the countertop in the kitchen next to the sink. An empty alcohol-fragranted glass sat in Anthony's hand, being gripped from the top. He looked to have not shaved in days. His hair was unkempt, and he was still wearing the same dress shirt and pants that he had been wearing for almost 2 weeks. Layers of sweat stains under his armpits were visible, and his tie was loosened around his neck, looking like a noose. He reeked of booze, cigarettes, and B.O., but oddly enough, he couldn't smell anything other than the smoke from the fire and his wife's perfume. The house he was in was located at 1962 Smithfield Street in Youngstown and was perfect for what he and Catherine needed. It was a small single-family bungalow with a front porch as well as a full garage. Anthony picked this house because it wasn't too far from the neighborhood where his family lived, and it wasn't too far from his law office, where he would often walk to in order to save money. The house, however, was not the welcoming home that he had envisioned. It was now quiet, cold, dark, and empty. The softest voice or softest sound seemed to echo through the plaster walls. He hated being cooped up in this godforsaken house, but he also didn't have anywhere else he needed to go or could go. He was avoiding talking to or seeing members of his family, especially his mom. Like any caring Italian mother, every time she came to see her son, she would bring loads of food to fill up his freezer with, but Anthony never touched any of it. He simply didn't have an appetite, and the looseness of his clothes were a result of his poor diet. His mom also seemed to always want to talk about it. She couldn't understand why Anthony didn't want to. What aggravated Anthony more than anything was the fact that his mother had blabbered to everyone in the neighborhood and most of Youngstown by now about it. Last time he went back to the old West Side or Mill Creek Park neighborhood, that's all everyone wanted to talk about. It seemed to become synonymous with his name and his family's name, and he didn't like it. He was sure that his mom had good intentions and that she was just simply sharing her feelings as a way to cope with the bad news, but she and everyone else simply didn't understand that he just didn't want to talk about it. The house appeared to ache along with him. The wooden floor seemed to moan and groan through the long sleepless nights, accompanied by the slow dripping water faucet, which, of course, had to act up when his dad was here and called the plumber who came in record time to service it. Oh, what Anthony would do to have those sounds right about now. If it were nighttime, he'd be able to open up a window and hear the sounds of the crickets at least, but nighttime was still 2 hours away. For right now, the only thing that could be heard were the sounds of the crackling fire, which helped soften the putrid silence. Noticing that the fire was simmering down, Anthony stood up to add more to the fire. So he went over to the bookshelf, which sat next to the fireplace, grabbed another handful of books, and tossed them into the fire. He then proceeded to walk back to his kitchen and proceeded to go over to the liquor cabinet and grab the only bottle of alcohol left, which was a bottle of peppermint schnapps, his wife's favorite. He debated on whether or not to open the unopened bottle. Looking down at the bottle, he saw that there was a red ribbon tied to the bottleneck. As he looked at it, he swore he heard the door open and close. Hoping it was Catherine, he put the bottle back in the cabinet, closed the door, and walked over to the front door, but saw nobody standing there. Anthony's face fell, and his shoulders looked like they had been crushed by a large amount of weight. He then went back to the liquor cabinet and grabbed the bottle of peppermint schnapps, and then took a second look at the red ribbon. At the end of the ribbon was a note which read, "To Kat and Anthony, God's blessings. Love, Deb." Knowing that this gift was from Catherine's wealthy aunt, who Catherine was close with, he decided to put the bottle back in the cabinet and close the door. As he walked back into the kitchen, he knew all too well that the fire was not going to last long, and the house was practically silent already. So, he proceeded to walk over to the sink, put his empty glass inside, turned on the water, and let the water run down the drain. He then walked back to his chair, sat down, and enjoyed the sounds of running water vibrating throughout the house, foolishly waiting for his wife to return home and put an end to his emptiness. One year later, March 26th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0700.
It says, "Turn to me, O Lord, and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. Relieve the troubles of my heart and bring me out of my distress. Consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins."
The boss was sitting at the chapel on base, and was watching Father Motz, the Catholic chaplain on base, read a section from Psalm 25, 16 and 17. As he did, the boss refrained from rolling his eyes, for he was worried that the chaplain would catch him and think he was being disrespectful. So, he took in a deep, longing breath and exhaled in a slow, simmering manner. He honestly didn't know why he was even sitting here. It wasn't that he didn't believe in God, he did. But he was just absolutely furious with him and was only here to please the Almighty enough that he would keep him breathing for just one more day. Plus, he also knew that his mother would be happy to know that her son was still being a good Roman Catholic and attending Sunday Mass whenever he could. Looking around, he saw the room was full of airmen, both officers and enlisted. The men were all listening to the chaplain's coffee-fueled sermon, and as they did, the boss wondered how many of the men sitting in this room were here with hearts as heavy as his. The loss of Roush and Duke was tragic, sad, and deserved time to mourn. But he knew all too well that mourning can be like quicksand, something that once you fall into it, it's hard to get back out. Both men were good pilots and good men. Duke was by far one of the nicest officers the boss had ever met since they arrived in Thurlow. The story about the replacement co-pilot that brought the crew of Georgia Belle back home had become iconic, almost mythical-like. The crew, what's now remaining of it, felt that their plane was now cursed due to the fact that on the last three missions, Georgia Belle had it rough. Three missions ago, the plane belly-landed. Then the next mission, the plane landed but with no flaps, no brakes, and the left landing gear wouldn't come down, and the plane nearly crashed on the runway. On that same mission, both Duke's original bombardier and navigator were killed, and, in a moment of irony, the co-pilot had returned back to Thurlow and died days later. Then, on the very next mission, with a new, experienced bombardier, navigator, and co-pilot, Duke was the one who was killed, along with his bombardier, navigator, and, oddly enough, his co-pilot would return back and would die days later. The similarities were striking. And because of it, no officer in the 300th wanted to take Georgia Bell up in the sky. Bill Roush was also very much missed, for he was quiet, sarcastic, and reminded the boss of his brother, Benny. After the sermon was done, the boss walked outside and lit up a fresh cigarette. He looked up into the cloudy sky and watched as a group of birds flew by, a sign that spring was starting. 1 month ago today, the boss and his men had arrived in Thurlow, with the idea of war still being a glimmer in their eye. It also had been 3 or so weeks since that glimmer had disappeared on their first mission. The boss understood that this was not what he thought he'd be faced with when he joined the Army Air Corps. This was a lot for him to process, and he found that constantly thinking about death and even talking about those who had been killed only made him feel worse, not better. The boss found himself thinking about Al and the sound of his voice and knew that he had to quickly divert his mind. Just then, a man walked past him on his way out of the chapel, and on a second look of the man, the boss was shocked to see that he recognized the man's face and was shocked that he didn't notice him in the crowd.
Mickey?
The man turned around and, judging by his eyes, which still refrained from making eye contact with the boss, knew that it was in fact Mickey.
Yes?
Mickey asked. Mickey! Holy hell! It's me! Anthony Backus! The boss! Remember? The boss walked up to Mickey and saw that he looked confused for a moment. Then, he quickly looked at the boss's face, and when he did so, a huge smile appeared on his face and he said,
Oh yeah, the boss, of course. Good to see you're still alive.
You too. You had me worried there. I didn't think you would remember me.
Oh, yeah. No, I do. Sorry, I meant no offense.
None taken. So what the hell happened to you?
I've been asking around, trying to find out what happened to the best pilot in the 8th Air Force, asked the boss.
Oh, I went to see Dr. Walker. My head's been all cleary and needed cleared up. You know, my brain was running on empty, like a car when it's been driving for too long. Who knew that the brain just runs on sleep? I guess sleep was all that I needed, you know?
Oh, okay. So, are you okay now?
The boss asked.
Yeah, tip-top pop.
Tip-top pop, okay. That's a new Mickeyism. Say, why don't we go back to my hut? You remember Rosie and Andy, right?
Oh, yeah, I do. What happened to the other guy? Did he get murdered?
Mickey asked.
Oh, you mean Jack. No, he's still with us. He's been spending his time with a different group recently. Anyways, let's catch up over some coal-fed coffee,
the boss said, walking with Mickey down the curved road towards his hut. Willie and Tommy were sitting in the enlisted men's mess hall, eating breakfast with Mason Pointers from Deuces. Joining the three men was Deuces' new waist gunner, 20-year-old Attila Yoder of Mercer, Pennsylvania. Attila had a shy, awkward nature to him that made the men like Willie suspicious of him, since he did not trust men who couldn't hide their nervousness. In fact, it took him 2 weeks to warm up to Skimpy, and that was his own crew member. Willie, Tommy, and Mason were engaged in a conversation about the likelihood that one of them could score a night with the bombshell on the base, a nurse named Cheryl Biddle. The only thing the men knew about her was her name, profession, and that she was from somewhere in New York.
Listen, hear me out, okay? Why don't we find out what time she leaves the hospital and heads back to her quarters, and then we just happen to run into her,
Tommy proposed.
So you want all three of us to Sherlock Holmes our way into finding out what time this poor girl leaves, and then we're all three gonna just approach her?
Willie asked.
No, see, that's the thing. We can each take turns on different nights approaching her, and whoever gets lucky wins,
Tommy replied.
This poor girl's gonna wonder why the same three men keep bothering her. But hey, I'm willing to try it, Mason added.
Well, why don't you guys just go, you know, to the hospital and just ask her?
Attila asked. All three men looked over at Attila with a look of disbelief, and Tommy responded with,
Attila, you're new to these parts, so I'm gonna give you a pass on that. But have you ever been to the hospital on this base?
No, have you?
Attila asked.
Well, no, not physically, but I have heard enough about it to know that it's not the place you go to ask a woman out on a date,
explained Tommy.
Yeah, you mean to tell me that you, good sir, would just walk into a room full of bloodied up, butchered up, angry men and ask this girl on a date? Willie asked. And imagine if she said no. Talk about being shot down, Mason added. Okay, that's a good point, Attila commented. We could always find out where her hut is on the base and just go up to her that way, Willie proposed.
I think her ideas are getting worse, commented Tommy.
Yeah, they are. Let's just hope we run into her somewhere else. At this point, I'm willing to be rejected than to live the rest of my life without ever knowing, said Mason.
Well, what's the big deal with this girl? I mean, she can't be that stunning,
Attila inquired.
Stunning?
Whoo! Said Tommy before being cut off by Willie. She's the embodiment of God's blessings bestowed upon mankind. Her beauty could start a war. Let me describe her for you.
Attila cracked a smile and listened closely as Willie ran through his description, while Tommy acted out or pointed to whatever Willie was saying.
She's got the nicest set of kissers you've ever seen. Blonde, no, not blonde. Golden hair that looks so pure and fine. Fucking Roosevelt wants you to take it off of her fucking head and put it back in the reserves. She's got hips built for a future mama. She's got legs to go all the way up to Scotland. And, this is the best part, bazoomas that will blow your fucking pecker off.
He's not kidding, Mason added. Blow my pecker off, huh? Attila asked.
I'm telling you, she is so beautiful it hurts, commented Tommy.
Well, all right, you sold me. I've got to see this broad, Attila said before taking a sip of his coffee.
Well, help us get a moment with her, and you, my friend, can be the first one to try and score, Willie said.
Oh, I don't know about that, Attila sheepishly said.
What, you don't like women? Willie asked.
No, it's not that, Attila said. If you've got a girl back home waiting for you, don't worry about it. So what? Who cares? She'll never find out that you asked a girl out just to amuse your friends, Tommy joked.
No, it's not that either. Oh, you think she's going to be interested until she finds out that your name is fucking Attila, Willie guessed.
No, it's that, you know, that's someone's daughter. I just feel weird treating her like she's some animal we're trying to hunt down, Attila admitted.
Well, you think that's what we're doing, pal, huh? You think that that's what we're about? Well, buddy, I hate to tell you this, but you're absolutely fucking right. But you're wrong about one thing, and that is this. Women like to be hunted down, Willie said.
Is that so? How often have you challenged this assumption?
Attila asked as he was about to take a bite of a piece of bacon. More than you, buddy, all right? Now, don't talk with your mouth full, okay? It's fucking disgusting, Willie fired back before continuing the small talk.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast. Later that day, a majority of the men on the base were issued 24-hour passes that went until 1,500 hours the next day. Jack, Parnell, O'Brien, Leslie, and Moose were walking from the officer mess halls and were headed back to their huts in order to change out of their fatigues and into something more formal. The plan was for the men to head to the much-anticipated and highly regarded Bury St. Edmunds for a night of pub-hopping, since Leslie was able to get the men a jeep and he knew all the best places to go in the city.
"Say, Louie, you don't happen to have any gum chew on you, do you?" O'Brien asked.
"Sorry, I don't. Why?" Jack asked.
"My breath is something fierce today," O'Brien said, lifting up his hand and pushing his breath onto his hand so he could smell it.
"Try brushing, O'Brien," Parnell joked.
"It's Sunday. I only bathe and brush on Fridays. You guys know this," O'Brien joked.
"I always wondered why England smelled better on Fridays," Jack joked back.
"Speaking of which, does anyone find it rather funny that the only time the weather is decent in England is when we're experiencing hell up in the sky,
But when we're on the ground and not flying a mission, away from hell, the sky is always dark, gloomy, and depressing, Parnell asked.
It's always been like that. I honestly don't think I've ever seen the sun since I've been here in England,
Moose added. I've heard the village elders speak of that fireball in the sky, but I personally haven't seen such rubbish in my lifetime, Jack joked. Say, I've heard a lot about this Bury St. Edmunds. What's it like? Parnell asked the group.
Well, O'Brien, you've been there, haven't you?
Leslie asked.
It was one of the first places we went to when we got a 24-hour pass, O'Brien answered.
Okay, so you know then. It's just a hub of activity, and it's a lot closer than London. It's perfect for a 24-hour pass, Leslie answered.
What do you mean by it's a hub? Parnell asked.
It's just... You'll see. There's just a lot of U.S. bases located around St. Edmunds, and because of that, there's just a lot of pubs, nice ones too. There's even a place called Moxie. Leslie was getting ready to explain what it was before he was cut off by O'Brien.
Is that the place in the basement?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of in a basement, but it's definitely different. They have Coca-Cola in there too.
Coca-Cola?
O'Brien asked.
Yeah, is Coca coming with us? Leslie asked.
He better be, O'Brien joked. What else does this place have? Parnell asked.
Well, they play swing music. I think they actually have their own band. Lots of girls, both British and American. There's a cigar shop. They make American cocktails. And, you know, I think it's actually meant to be an American-themed type place, Leslie explained.
Well, I'm up for it. That sounds awesome. I just hope Cook and the others can come, Jack commented as the men walked towards their huts.
That night, Bury St. Edmunds was bustling with activity. Honey Hill, a street in the city's southeastern end, where Moxie was located, was swarmed with airmen, soldiers, engineers, and other American personnel. Jack was walking with the slightly intoxicated Parnell on their way to the Moxie, which was just around the corner. Parnell was commenting on the beauty of St. Mary's Church, which was just off to their left. Jack and Parnell had become quite close friends over the last couple of days, and the two seemed to be enjoying each other's company over the course of the evening. With them was Joe Broland, O'Brien, Coca, Sheila, Leslie, Aris, Moose, and Roebuck, and the three officers from Parnell's crew. All throughout the night, the large group of friends would split off into their own groups as they went from pub to pub, but then would meet back up a few pubs later. Walking in front of the group was Brolin, O'Brien, and Adam Brooks, Parnell's co-pilot. The three men heard Parnell's comments on the church and added to the conversation.
They don't have them like that in Massachusetts, do they? Joe asked.
That's because this thing was probably built before America was even a nation, Parnell responded.
I do have to give it to you Catholics. You sure do know how to build a nice cathedral, Adam commented.
That's not a Catholic church, Jack corrected.
Well, what is it then? Lutheran? Adam asked.
Church of England, I believe. If I'm not mistaken, Mary Tudor, who was at one time the Queen of France, she was named after this church, and I think she's actually buried here, Jack explained.
No shit,
Roland said, turning around and walking backwards so he could get one more look at the cathedral, which was being partially illuminated by the moon.
Well, aren't you just a walking history lesson, Louis? O'Brien poked.
Well, what can I say? Jack awkwardly replied.
As the men turned the corner onto Sparhawk Street, the small, narrow, picturesque English street where the Moxie was located, the men talked more about the comparisons between England and the United States. As they did, Jack noticed a group of men turning onto Sparhawk Street coming from the opposite side of Honey Hill. Looking closer at the group, Jack was shocked that he recognized them. The boss was walking with Michael Shelby and his co-pilot, James McCoy, Mickey, and the freshly healed up Ronald or Ronnie Smith, Mickey's pilot. The group of men were headed to Moxie as well, since it was one of Ronnie's favorite places to go, and he had talked it up to the boss, who couldn't wait to go. Jack nudged Parnell and interrupted the point he was making to O'Brien and brought his attention to the boss and the others across the street.
Hey, is that the boss?
Parnell looked at the tall officer and saw Michael Shelby sitting next to him, who had gained the reputation in the 530th Squadron as being the boss's mini-me, and said to Jack,
"Looks like him, and that kid Shelby.
You know what, let's find out." Jack was getting ready to ask Parnell what he was planning on doing, but before he had a chance to, Parnell yelled out,
"Hey, asshole!"
The boss and the others looked over, and after seeing the boss's face straight on, Parnell turned around to Jack and said,
"Yep, that's him." Thanks, Parnell. Don't know what I'd do without you, Jack softly said. As the others laughed at Parnell, Jack ran across the street over to the boss.
What are you doing here?
Jack asked, attempting to be friendly.
We're headed to the Moxie, you?
The boss asked.
We're headed there too,
Jack said before quickly getting cut off by Ronnie, who yelled across the street.
Hey, which one of you guys is the one who called me an asshole?
Parnell yelled back.
I did, you fuck. What are you gonna do about it?
The tension broke when Joe Brolin yelled out,
Son of a bitch! Do my eyes deceive me?
Which was then followed by a moose, who excitedly spoke up by saying,
Ronnie! I thought you were never coming back!
Ronnie was a brown-haired, redneck brawler from northern Texas, and even though he had only flown a total of 5 missions since he arrived in England, he had earned himself quite the reputation. Men like the boss and Jack had heard all about Ronnie from when Mickey would tell them stories about him. Ronnie had a carelessness to him that the boss was oddly drawn to. In the boss's eyes, he wasn't like Joe Brolin or Parnell. Ronnie had a southern charm to him and carried himself like an old southern football coach.
I thought that too. They took 3 metal pieces out of my old ham,
Ronnie said, turning around and pointing to his buttocks.
How are you now?
Joe asked as the men all crossed the street and arrived at Ronnie and the others.
I feel like $1 million, which needs a goddamn drink right about now,
Ronnie said.
Well, that's perfect. We're going to the place that's just perfect for that,
Leslie commented.
Well, how have you boys been? So glad to see your pudgy baby-bottom faces. I see you boys still can't grow facial hair,
Ronnie said, using his hand to rub Leslie's face and giving it a slight slap, to which Leslie cracked a smile. Jack observed the situation and marveled at the fact that men like Leslie, Joe, and even people like Moose looked at Ronnie like a child does to his father. There had been some fatherly types that Jack and the others had met and experienced since they arrived in England, but Ronnie was a different animal. His charisma and his confidence, and the way that he moved around the men standing around him, it was like a proud father being surrounded by his kids. The men all began walking, and soon they arrived at the Moxie. The men walked through a brick archway that led to an open gravel lot, lined with rows of 2-story terraced houses. Leslie informed the men that in some of these houses were local prostitutes who made a living off drunk airmen, specifically officers, stumbling out of the pub. To the men's right was a long brick 2-story building, with the first floor being semi-underground. The building's second story had boarded-up windows, and the words Moxie were painted on a large white canvas that was pinned to the building.
This is it, fellas. Moxie, where boys become men, Leslie said as he allowed the others to enter first.
Brolin, O'Brien, and Adam were the first ones to enter, with Jack, Parnell, Moose, and Aris following behind. The entrance was down a short flight of steps and through a large wooden door with boarded-up windows on each side. Once inside, the room smelled of cigarettes, booze, sweat, and women's perfume. The interior of the long, narrow room was not what Jack and the others were expecting. The ceiling was low, only being 7 feet high off the wooden floor. At one end of the room was a stage where a swing band was playing. Along the sidewall was the bar, with posters and signs from American brands, movies, and such being hung up on the wall. Above the bar was a large neon Coca-Cola sign, with a neon bottle of Coca-Cola next to it. The room was filled with men and women, all dancing provocatively on the dance floor. As the men would soon find out, upstairs were rooms for couples who wanted to get some privacy, and a lounge with tables. As the men stood close to the doorway, observing the world that was in front of them, the men were captivated, yet perplexed. Jack had never seen such a thing before, and he wasn't sure if he would ever experience this kind of thing ever again. In Haverhill, the boys of the Bull and the boys from Dropping Deuces were all sitting in a pub and hotel known as Rose and Crown. The men were all drinking in the back corner. Willie, Tommy, and Mason Pointers were sitting up against the wall and were laughing amongst themselves, barely able to get words out, but somehow the others were able to make out what they were saying and would crack up some more. Sitting along the other wall was Beans, Pally, Attila, and Terrence Mercier, who had his hand wrapped up from the fire in Deuces' cockpit the day before. Beans and the others looked at Willie, Tommy, and Mason laughing with such entertainment, even laughing with them in some parts. Part of this was due to the fact that Tommy's laugh was so childish and so deep from his soul that it was highly infectious and contagious. Mills was with Evelyn, who were upstairs in one of the hotel rooms. The two were passionately and zealously making love, so much so that the bedpost was thumping up against the plaster walls, which were being projected into the room next to them, along with Evelyn's inability to keep quiet and Mills's inability to realize how loud they were being. In the room next door, Skimpy and Emma were both laying in bed, with one ear pressed into the mattress and the other one being covered by their pillow. The two were laughing to themselves as a way to make light of the awkward moment. Neither one of them knew who was having sex in the room next door, but they hoped that it would soon be over with. Downstairs, the boys were enjoying their night when Tommy noticed someone familiar walking into the pub and hotel. It was the blonde-haired woman from the hospital, Cheryl. Tommy stopped laughing, almost on a dime, and said, hitting both Willie and Mason,
"Oh, shit. Guys, shit. That's her. That's who? Oh, dear Lord,"
Mason said, seeing the blonde woman enter into the room, wearing her wool olive drab jacket, skirt, and stockings.
"This is our chance,"
Willie said, quickly getting up, with Tommy falling behind. The rest of the men watched with looks of such amusement on their faces. As they waited to see the outcome of this dual attempt to get with arguably one of the most beautiful women on the base. Willie and Tommy both approached Cheryl, and she was walking to a table where three other army nurses were sitting, along with a group of local officers. Once Tommy saw the officers, he began to have doubts, but Willie was insistent on trying and continued his path. Cheryl arrived at the table, sat down, but quickly looked over at the two enlisted men walking up to her.
"Let me start," Willie whispered to Tommy, as he then quickly slid himself onto the only seat left on the wooden booth, which was across from Cheryl.
The others at the table were perplexed with this enlisted man whom he had never met, who just sat down at their table.
"Can we help you, pal?" asked one of the officers.
"You can't, but she can," Willie said, looking at Cheryl.
"Ma'am, how do I say this? You are by far the most beautiful woman me or my friend have ever seen. When we're up there fighting the Huns, defending our guys and our country, I want you to know that me and my friend here, we do show with you on our minds the entire time. I know we're just enlisted men, while you're a second lieutenant, is she? That there's never going to be a chance that we're going to ever have this time face to face ever again. Unless, God forbid, we end up in the hospital. Now, my father told me, and I think you would agree with this, that when rare moments happen, you should never take them for granted. So, how is it about you humor me and my buddy here and allow us to buy you a drink at the bar, and we get 20 minutes to conversate with the woman who gives us the courage to fight?" Cheryl was stunned into silence at the proposal. She wasn't sure how to answer. The officers who she was sitting with, along with the two nurses, looked at Tommy and Willie with looks that made Tommy feel like he and Willie had made a huge mistake. After a long pause, Willie took the silence as a rejection and apologized for being so brazen and got up and began walking away with Tommy. Then, they were both stunned when they heard Cheryl call out for the two boys to wait. Turning around, they saw Cheryl getting up and walking over to them. Tommy's nerves were so shot that he felt like he was going to faint at the intensity of the situation. "Yes?" Willie asked.
"That was strange, but bold. What's your name?" Cheryl asked Willie.
"Tech Sergeant William Abram."
"And you?" Cheryl asked Tommy.
Sergeant Thomas Mathis."
"Well, Tech Sergeant William Abram and Tech Sergeant Thomas Mathis, you men are bold and brave, I'll give you that. And thank you for the compliments, but I don't think it will be wise for me to take you up on your offer. However, to make whatever that was somewhat worth it, how about I give you boys something to take home with you?"
Cheryl then leaned in and gave Willie and Tommy both kisses on their cheeks before she thanked the men again and returned to her seat. Both Willie and Tommy looked at one another with such excitement, and they both, with their chests puffed out, returned to their table and sat down like proud old men after a hard day's work.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you, because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue.
In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. It had been almost an hour since the men arrived at the Moxie, and most of the men were enjoying themselves jitterbugging with beautiful women on the dance floor. Leslie and his men were among those dancing the night away. Parnell and the four men from his crew were over by the bar, drinking with Brolin, Coca, and Sheila. O'Brien, Jack, and Michael Shelby were currently standing outside Moxie, urinating on the side of the building. Jack had taken a liking to Shelby, but couldn't help but notice the look that he gave the boss. Jack recognized it, for it was the same look that he used to give to the boss. He wondered if perhaps the boss was right, and putting someone like Michael Shelby in the co-pilot seat would be better for him and the rest of the crew. Jack, with a lit cigarette in his mouth, said, "You know, Shelby, the boss seems to be taking a liking to you." "I mean, we are friends after all," Shelby commented. "Of course, but do you see him as a competent leader?" Jack asked as he zipped himself up and turned towards Shelby, who was also zipping up. "What are you doing, Louie?" O'Brien asked.
"What? I'm just asking,"
Jack responded, taking the cigarette out of his mouth.
"Yeah, sure. I see him as a competent leader,"
Shelby responded. "Well, he doesn't seem too keen on keeping me and his crew. For whatever reason, he hasn't been the same since Berlin," Jack said.
"I know. He told me about everything. You made him feel like a real piece of shit. Can't say it wasn't deserved, but honestly, what are you trying to do?
Shelby asked.
"I just think that maybe, you know, perhaps you'd be a better fit for him and the crew," Jack said.
O'Brien was shocked by this and turned towards Jack and said,
"Louie, come on. You're not saying what I think you just said."
"Well, listen, I'm just thinking, it could be the beer talking," Shelby interrupted by saying,
"Listen, I don't like my co-pilot, okay? I think that's obvious. But I would feel awful leaving him and my crew to go with someone else, wouldn't you?"
Shelby asked.
"Yeah, of course I would," Jack responded. "All right, well, look, don't entertain the idea or thought ever again. Besides, it makes you look and sound like a pathetic runt, okay?"
Shelby jabbed as he patted Jack on his shoulder. Jack didn't say anything back but watched as Shelby headed back inside, with O'Brien following behind him. Jack soon went in as well. Upstairs, the boss was sitting at one of the club chairs and tables. The room upstairs was dark, smoky, and all the tables were illuminated by the ceiling lamps that only gave enough light to see the table that was below it. More posters and neon signs hung along the walls. A bright red light illuminated one wall in the back of the room. Sitting at the table with him was Mickey and Shelby's co-pilot, James McCoy, who to the boss reminded him a lot of Jack, but only McCoy talked a lot. Jack was a talker, but nothing like this. The boss came up here to escape the large crowd and asked McCoy a simple question to find out where McCoy was from. That was 15 minutes ago, and the kid was still talking. The entire time McCoy talked, the boss kept looking over at Mickey, who seemed to stare into nothing, looking lifeless and emotionless. The boss recognized that look because he had given it many times before joining up. It was weird seeing Mickey so dull, quiet, and timid. He was actually quite the buzzkill now. As the boss listened to McCoy talk some more, he saw a familiar face emerge from the hallway that led to the five small rooms. It was Ronnie, with two women dressed in floral gowns following behind. When Ronnie saw Mickey and the boss's face, he went over to their table and gave each woman a kiss and paid both of them before he told them to go downstairs and get themselves something to drink at the bar and enjoy their evening. The women looked at the wad of cash that Ronnie gave them, and they both, in a moment of surprise and shock, thanked Ronnie before heading downstairs. Ronnie then sat down across from the boss and McCoy, next to Mickey, with his dress shirt untucked, jacket unbuttoned, and tie undone around his neck, and red lipstick smear on both sides of his face.
Were those two girls,
McCoy began to ask, but sheepishly didn't say the word.
"What, whores? Well, if they weren't that before today, I'd say they earned themselves that badge of courage,"
Ronnie said as he leaned forward and grabbed Mickey's cocktail, which he hadn't touched. Mickey didn't even notice or care.
Ronnie, don't you have a girl back home? The boss asked, looking somewhat disgusted by Ronnie's debauchery. Allison? No. She's not my girl. She's just a girl that I knew in my neighborhood. Nothing special. What about you? Ronnie asked, putting a cigarette in his mouth. I'm happily married, the boss said.
I call bullshit. You're either happy or you're married. You can't be both.
I see. Well, did you at least have fun? The boss asked, watching Ronnie light up a cigarette.
You bet your ass I did. I had a whole month of government money piling up, and I haven't been able to spend any of it. Besides, they got them nurses in the hospital drop-dead gorgeous. Mickey can testify. One of them, sweet little thing named Cheryl, she got every man watching her when she enters into a room. Ain't that right, Mickey?
Mickey nodded his head with a smile, but didn't seem to move his eyes.
Yeah, so I've been all boned up for some time. But don't worry, though. I gave each of them plenty enough money to make it worth their while, Ronnie said.
The boss scoffed at Ronnie's comment, and Ronnie saw the boss's reaction and said,
What, is something wrong?
No, it's just, I saw you turn your nose up.
Listen, judge all you want. But when you've seen the shit that I've seen, and you've been where I've been, and you've heard what I've heard, then you're going to see the world a lot differently, trust me, pal.
You do know that I've flown 4 missions, right? You're just 1 mission ahead of me, the boss pointed out.
Listen, that don't mean shit, son. I hate to tell you, but may I remind you, sorry I had to do this to you, Mickey.
Ronnie said, looking over at Mickey, who was still mindlessly staring off in the distance, as Ronnie continued his point to the boss.
2 of the guys that we flew over the pond with were both shot down the first week we were here. Then we fly 3 back-to-back missions during Big Week, and by the end of that 3rd day, we simply didn't give a damn. Then on our next mission, I get flak shoved up my ass, and have to lay on my stomach for 3 weeks hearing men cry, scream, and talking to themselves all goddamn day. That makes a man want to blow his own brains out. Then, not to mention, I'm told that 2 of my waist gunners are dead, my radio man's back in the hospital after just getting out, my tail gunner, who was like a son to me, died because of an oxygen malfunction, and nobody bothered to fucking realize until it was way too goddamn late. My ball turret gunner was sent home, my navigator nearly died, and my co-pilot was sent to the loony bin for 2 weeks. So excuse me if I want to deal with the snafu, which is this shit, by paying 2 beautiful Brits to show me some love. Got it?
The boss didn't say anything further. He just stared at Ronnie. What bothered the boss more than anything was, he not only understood what Ronnie was saying, but he wondered if he was a lot closer to becoming Ronnie than he was comfortable with. Back in Haverhill, Willie, Tommy, Pally, and Beans had gotten a room at the hotel and were just across the hallway from Mills' room and Skimpy's room. While Mills and Evelyn had come downstairs after their night of passionate lovemaking and continued to drink the night away in the company of their friends, Skimpy and Emma had stayed up in their room, and they too enjoyed some physical intimacy before falling asleep for the night. In Willie, Tommy, Pally, and Beans' room, Willie and Tommy both were laying on one of the 2 queen-size beds in the room, while Beans and Pally slept on the other one. Willie, who had his head propped up against the headboard and pillow, had a bottle of wine in his hand that he had swiped off a table downstairs, and he took a drink and then offered it to Tommy, who was laying the same way. As Tommy took a drink, Willie said,
What a night, fellas. This room was a perfect idea. To lay on something other than a bunk feels like we're lying on a cloud by comparison.
I'm going to say you're right, Willie, Beans commented as he was lying on his bed, looking up at the ceiling. Pally nodded his head in agreement and said,
I honestly can't believe she kissed you guys.
Well, how do you think it feels to be us, Pally? I never was someone who believed in God, but when her lips touched my cheek, I believed. Because how can something be that great and not be made by God himself? Willie commented.
Right. I'm never washing my cheek as long as I live, Tommy commented.
Well, in that case, she's never going to kiss you on that cheek ever again, Pally said.
That's never going to happen again, Pally. That was it. That was as close to the promised land as I'll ever get, Tommy said as he rolled over and prepared himself to fall asleep.
You out, Tommy? Willie asked.
Yeah, my eyes can't keep up,
Tommy commented. All right, well, here, finish dish. I'm turning in too, Willie said before he got up off his bed, walked over to Pally and Beans' bed, and handed them the rest of the wine. Over the next few minutes, the boys all soundly and softly slipped into a deep alcohol-induced sleep, and would get the best night's sleep any of them had ever had, and sadly, would forever have. Hours later,
In Skimpy's room, Skimpy and Emma were sound asleep, with Emma resting her head on Skimpy's chest. Suddenly, Emma was awoken when she realized her head was bobbing up and down rather quickly. She opened her eyes, looked at Skimpy, who was drenched in sweat. His head was swaying back and forth, and he seemed to be having a night terror. Emma then went to get up to check on Skimpy, but when her left hand pressed down onto the mattress, Skimpy violently was jolted awake. In a state of panic, he lunged himself at Emma, knocking her down off the bed and onto the floor. Emma hit her head off the wall, and the forceful drop caused a loud thud to echo throughout the room and down the hallway. Emma went to ask Skimpy what was going on, but before she could, Skimpy began yelling out,
"Go hide! Go hide! Flak 12 o'clock level! Hide! Hide!"
As he yelled this, Emma attempted to try and snap Skimpy out of his war-induced trance. The commotion and the word flak being yelled out loudly, again and again, Mills next door was awoken by the sound of yelling and loud thumping. Mills knew something was up, so he quickly jumped out of bed, waking Evelyn up, and made his way out to the hallway. Once out there, he heard a woman shouting, along with the man's continual yelling coming from the room next door. Debating on whether or not to involve himself, he took a deep breath, and with Evelyn now standing behind him, ran into the room and was shocked to see Skimpy laying on top of Emma, looking like he was protecting her from something. Mills stood in confusion, but once he heard what Willie was yelling and saw Skimpy squeezing his left hand as though he were engaging his microphone cord on the plane, Mills realized what was going on. He got down on the floor and forcefully pulled Skimpy off of Emma, with Skimpy yelling the word no over and over and over again, followed by commands to take cover and put on flak jackets. As Mills tried dragging Skimpy onto his bed, Mills tripped over Emma's shoe, and the two fell on the bed and then rolled onto the floor. Mills began yelling at the top of his lungs, waking up and startling everyone down the hallway.
"Skimpy! Skimpy! Skimpy, it's me, Mills! Charlie!"
At hearing his name, Skimpy stopped, became calm and softened. He then looked up at Mills and saw the look of terror on Mills' face. Then, out of confusion, he looked over at Emma and saw that she was on the verge of crying. He then saw bruises all over Emma's arms and face. Skimpy then realized that his right hand and forearm hurt and looked down to see Emma's mascara and lipstick smeared onto his forearm. He then looked up and saw Evelyn standing in the doorway, looking so terrified at what she was seeing, she forgot to cover herself up under her robe. There was a moment of silence in the room, and soon, Willie, Tommy, and the others arrived in the doorway to check out what the yelling was all about. Skimpy then burst into tears after finally realizing what he had done. The look on Emma's face tore him up. Mills sat up, held Skimpy to his chest, and allowed him to unload every emotion-filled tear until there was no more left, while the two girls watched in horror and disbelief.
Thank you for listening to episode 15 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness of the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies over Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you guys so much for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 16 of Snafu, Dying Skies.